welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Thank you for tuning in, new and regular listeners. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sweden. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays doing internet talk radio on a wide variety of subjects that we consider to be important and of interest. Our website is redicecreations.com, R-E-D-I-C-E, creations.com, where you will find frequently updated news, our radio archive, and of course our member section with our entire archive of radio and video material. All information is available on redicecreations.com. And I'm glad you're here today because we are going to talk about a kind of an unreported issue, actually, even in the realm of conspiracy research. Many of you might not know, and a few of you might have forgotten about the deadliest maritime disaster, in quotes there, in the late 20th century. We are talking about MS Estonia that sank in the Baltic Sea on September the 28th, 1994, claiming over 800 lives. There have been many theories, many ideas, many computer models and illustrations to try to explain what happened that night and why the ship actually went down. What makes this story more intriguing is the fact that in the aftermath of the disaster, many relatives of the deceased demanded that their loved ones should be raised from international waters and given a land burial. Demands were also made that the entire ship should be raised up so that the cause of the disaster could be discovered by a detailed inspection. And citing the practical difficulties and the moral kind of implications of raising decaying bodies from the sea floor. By the way, the majority of the bodies were never recovered, but also fearing the financial burden for the costs of lifting the entire hull from the surface and the salvage operation of the Swedish government suggested burying the whole ship in its place with a shell of concrete. And in the end, the Estonia Agreement of 1995, a treaty between Sweden, Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Denmark, Russia, and the United Kingdom, though the UK not itself is a Baltic state, they declared sanctity over the site, prohibiting its citizens from even approaching the wreck. The treaty is, however, only binding for citizens of the countries that are the signatories. The Swedish Navy has at least twice discovered illegal diving operations at the wreck, and the wreck is monitored by radar by the Swedish Navy. And so, I mean, there's a whole story here why the cover-up has taken place and why there's such a big effort, so to speak, preventing people from going down there. And this, of course, those of you who are curious and are bound to ask questions about these things know that this is a kind of a red herring right here. And this is, of course, what we're going to talk more about today. And you're going to hear it from a new perspective, so to speak. We have author and lawyer Henning Witte with us on the line to talk about MS Estonia and what he believes really happened and why there have been such a big effort to cover up the site and the evidence. So with that, welcome to the program, Henning Witte, and thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. This is a very interesting story. And first off, I guess we can mention you are, of course, the author of a book called, in Swedish here, MS Estonia sänktes. I just have to ask you right away, is there any English version available of this book, Henning?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
It had been, but it was compromised by Christopher Bolin from American Free Press. He promised to do and publish, and he did not do it. And since that, it didn't happen. But I'll try to do it in the close future.
Okay, sounds very good. We can maybe talk about that more later on. That's interesting. But anyway, tell us a little bit about your background, Henning, and how kind of you first got involved in the MS Estonia story, if you will.
Yeah, I studied law in Sweden and Germany and started the first German law firm in Sweden in 93, specialized on the issues for law between companies investing in Germany or in Sweden. In that position, the biggest Swedish newspaper came to me and wanted to have a legal opinion about product liability in this case because they had the suspicion that the German shipbuilder, the Meyer Werft, builded in the wrong way, and that that caused the catastrophe. And that was the reason why I was involved with it. And by that, I came into the television and interviews there, and there the biggest groups of relatives, next of kin, found me and gave me the order to organize the litigation for almost 1,000 people in order to find out who is responsible.
Yes.
And at that time, we followed the mainstream media and commission and others, and that's why we focused on the shipbuilder, the German Meyerjahr, in the northern part of Germany, as one of the defendants, and the French company Bureau Veritas, who had controlled the ship also, and the Swedish Maritime Administration in Norrköping, Sweden, who also had made controlling jobs as a private entity for the Estonian state, because the Estonia was flagged in Estonia, a new Baltic state, just independent from the Soviet Union, and they got help from the Swedes, and
yes,
especially from the Swedish Maritime Administration.
Very interesting. And why don't we do like this? Then we can maybe begin to just kind of unravel the official story, or at least what we know at this point actually did take place. So, if you will, Henning, tell us about what happened to Estonia.
Yes. It was a usual ferry ship, a ro-ro ferry, on her way from Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, the little tiny Baltic state close to Russia in the Baltic Sea, from that capital Tallinn to Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. And they never came through in the middle of the way. They got heavy starboard list, and between 40 and 55 minutes from the first starboard list, the ship disappeared from the surface. And later on, the bad weather came, and a little storm, and in the beginning, the authorities said, oh, it was a storm causing it, but looking close, there was no storm when the capsizing or the sinking was. And very soon after that, a commission was founded from the Estonian state, because it was flagged in Estonia, from the Swedish state, because it was most Swedes on board and it was on the way to Sweden, and from the Finnish state, because the Finns made the rescue operations.
Yes.
And this commission very early came out with a part report and blamed on the German shipbuilder, and that it was a combination of bad design and bad weather. And, well, everybody believed that, including me.
Yes.
That's why we started our litigation in Paris, because this Bureau Veritas, the controlling institutes, is situated in Paris. And then during the preparation of this big litigation, people came to me, survivors, others, people working for the ship owner and so on, and told a totally different story from what was told officially. Officially, they said it was a high sea from the storm, and during the journey was about between 15 and 18 knots. They pushed against the waves, and the bow visor fall off because this pressure was too big and the construction of the bow visor was too weak.
Yes.
And falling off, the bow visor ripped the bow ramp open, the ramp which is used for the cars to enter the ferry deck. And now the deck was totally open and the water could pour in and on the car deck, and this caused the sinking of the ferry.
Yes.
Well, it sounds logical. If you don't know about shipbuilding, you buy this story. But then shipbuilders came and others and said, Henning, look, this is against the law of nature. If such a ship as the Estonia gets so much water on the car deck, it's capsizing and floating upside down could be several days because below the car deck is about 18,000 cubic meters of air trapped in the decks called Deck 0 and Deck 1.
Yes.
Where we have the swimming pool, the motor room, and the engine room, and the cheap apartments where people live. And it takes time for this trapped air to get out. So it was impossible for a boat like the Estonia, if you only have water on car deck, to sink within about 45 minutes,
yes.
Disappear from the surface. If this has happened, and there's no doubt about it, then there must be a leakage, an opening beneath the car deck, allowing all the trapped air to get out and water to come in.
Yes.
And there it was very easy for the experts to say the official explanation from the commission is a lie.
Hmm. Yes, I understand. And this is, you know, where everything, you know, becomes very interesting, so to speak, because I guess we can begin to talk a little bit about some of the survivors and some of the testimony and some of the people that came, approached you and relayed their story. What did they say that actually happened?
Yeah, they started that the timeline that the commission took up is totally wrong, that things started earlier, and that there were loud bangs, and several survivors said it sounded like explosions, that bombs exploded, and they have been suppressed with their testimony by the commission and by the Swedish and Finnish police. And they were quite frightened, some of them who came to me, and even to Jutta Rabe, the German journalist at that time working for Spiegel. Spiegel is in Germany the most serious medium with newspaper branch and television branch, and she was in the television part.
Mm-hmm.
She also contacted me in 96 and said, well, I detected so many strange things, and I could only agree that we combined our research. And she also got interesting inputs from Finland and Estonia, people contacting her and telling a totally different story. And very soon the story and information came that there was a weapons smuggle, that this could have been the reason to stop the boat, that was a reason for the officials to lie.
Okay, let's definitely get into that more later on, but let's continue to talk a little bit more about what potentially could have happened here then. So according to some of the testimonies, and I know the one that you spoken to quite extensively is Carl Övberg, isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. He's one of the survivors. He had an interesting position because he was below the car deck in the cheap department, and quite close to the bow, to the front of the vessel, and he said it was such a big impact that he was thrown backwards in his bed, and that he had the impression that they ran on ground, on a stone.
Yes.
And then when he quickly prepared to disembark, he saw that water was coming from beneath, not from above. The official story said water came in above on Kardec. That would have meant in his case that the water came on his head and not from beneath. And several other survivors from those cheap parts could confirm that the water came from beneath and not from above. And that is totally in relation with what every shipbuilder told us. There must have been a leakage down there below Kardec, that means below the waterline.
Yes. I mean, there have been so much talk about this, the bow visor that you mentioned before, and how this could have been possible and so forth. Do you know at this point if there is any, you know, footage about, you know, that shows this in any way? I mean, there have been recounts that people have been shown footage of the actual hole itself, where the possible explosion or bomb were placed, and consequently what has been seen is the metal bending outwards. Isn't that right?
Well, we have to point out that there are two different parts where we have pictures or indirect pictures. The best documented part is the part of the bow where the bow visor has been, but this is a part that only shows how water could come on Kardec. This is not the interesting part below Kardec that caused the sinking.
Yes.
And we only know by theory in the beginning that there must have been a leakage. And then, knowing that, if you go through the film material, there is official film material. Everybody has access to it.
Uh-huh, okay.
And the first reaction when I heard it was, okay, I buy everything from the commission, every film material, and look, because the whole wreck is filmed as far as it is sticking out of the mud. And interesting, and the part where every technician and survivor said that there, we suppose, must be a big hole, the film material is missing.
Uh-huh, really?
Yeah. And I asked the guys in Scotland who made it from Halliburton Enterprise.
No, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they said, well, there was the Swedish police involved, and they stopped the camera at certain points.
Yeah, there we go.
And then, of course, officially it was denied, but the guy told me that, and I can say so because I heard it from him.
Yes.
And then we looked closer and could detect that the Halliburton guys made one mistake, because they didn't cut everything away. And there's one interesting part documented both from the camera of the helmet from the diver and a so-called ROV, remote operated vehicle, as a big camera swimming in the water. It's big like a refrigerator. And so we have from both sources the pictures that they tried to get in to the Kardec by the ramp, which is not open but closed.
Yes.
There already you see the big lie, because officially the ramp was open. And then they say it's so much closed, you can't come into the ship that way. You must go down to the bottom, turn to the left, and then you can get in. And then you see the camera doing that, filming all the time. You see the depth and so on, and suddenly the camera is in the ship. And unfortunately, on that way into the ship, it is only dark. You can't see a hole in that way. Uh-huh. You only see that the camera is moving from outside to inside the ship on a spot where usually is nothing open. And this is an indirect proof that there is a big hole on the starboard side close to the bow,
yes,
below the waterline.
Yes.
And unfortunately, there are no direct pictures showing metal bent outwards on that part, which is the vital part for the sinking.
Okay.
What you told was pictures taken later on by Jutta Rabe and her expedition, and somewhat earlier in a worse condition, from the part where the visor attached, it was attached to the bow. There you can see a metal bent outwards, typical damages from bombs.
Yes.
And she was able to take two metal pieces from that part where the visor was attached to the bow and submitted them to scrutiny, and they showed clearly from four different institutes that they had been exposed for an explosion.
Really? And this and, is this material that never have been touched upon at all in mainstream media, or has this...
Yes, principally not, especially not in Sweden.
Yes.
Even the BBC made a cover-up on that. I had a good contact with the BBC, but when we came with this material, they ridiculed me and never broadcasted it.
Really?
Yeah. And so David Icke is right if he is criticizing the BBC.
Yes.
I detected it myself personally. Even Discovery Channel and those media, you can't rely on them.
Yes. Yeah. It's.
And, but the problem is these pictures showing the metal bent outward and the proofs from the metal pieces that there had been explosives. That only is evidence that the visor was blown away by bombs. But this is not the reason for the sinking.
Okay.
Because we know the sinking must have been caused by an opening below the cardec, and the visor is at the same level as the cardec.
Yes.
So this is only a proof for a terrorism. But it is not the proof for the sinking itself. The only proof there we have is this indirect picture where the camera is going from outside to inside at a place where no usual natural opening is.
Yes, and I guess we can go back to some of the testimony here, because as far as I recollect, there were people talking about two different explosions, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is right. At least two different explosions.
Yes.
Quite close in together at midnight Swedish time and 1 o'clock the Estonian time. That's right, and they came from the bow part. So it is quite possible that they heard one in blowing away the bow and the other making a big hole. It could also be that a submarine rammed the Estonia and made a hole causing the sinking.
Really?
Yes, or both, because a lot of survivors told us about scratching noises, as if another boat scratched on the hull of the Estonia.
Mm-hmm.
And psychics told me that they could see that there had been a submarine. They could not tell which nation, but they could see that, and that the submarine also got damages.
Okay, did you say psychics?
Yes, they phoned me and said what they saw together.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. One from Denmark and one from Sweden.
Okay, So this wasn't.
I believe there's a combination. It'd been a combination, but of bombs and submarine. But that's not a proof.
Yes, of course. It just might add up to the theory. We're trying to build an image here, so to speak, of what potentially might have happened, and this is just material that potentially adds to that picture, so to speak. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have this scenario here. Then we have testimony of people talking about two different explosions. The ship is going down in approximately 40 to 45 minutes, very quickly. Okay. So the obvious question, I guess, at this point is why and who would have wanted to take the ship down?
Yes, exactly. And there Jutta Rabe got from former German spy and Russian spy from the military GRU, Hannelore Marek, information that there had been weapons smuggling, special Russian weapons from space weapons, where the Russians still had the superiority in technology compared to the Americans, and that the U.S. did not want the Russians to have this superiority on that point either, and that the Americans in some way managed to come over those weapons by stealing them or buying them. You must know that in just the other half of 94, the Russians withdraw all the troops from the Baltic states, and they had the most modern equipment in the Baltic states.
Mm.
And there you can see a connection to the Kursk. In my eyes, it was the Americans who sank the Kursk because they didn't want supremacy from Russia anymore on the sea.
I just want to mention, for those who don't know, Kursk, that was a Russian, very advanced, actually, atomic submarine. Isn't that right, Henning?
Yeah, it was the flagship, the most modern and frightening they had built with modern technology. On the way to the first big exercise in the Mediterranean after the fall of the Soviet Union. It was August 2000.
Yes.
And they suddenly sank, and there were explosions, and Putin behaved very strange, and the Americans gave a lot of money to Putin and afterwards.
Yes,
and so on.
Yes.
And then what I know from Swedish military secret service and other sources, it was Americans who sank it because they didn't want the Russian competition on that spot. Because they wanted the new world order, and they all wanted to rule alone the whole world, and nobody has to interfere with that.
It's a huge story in itself, right there. I mean, obviously, and we'll see if we can talk more about that later on and how it ties into all of this, of course, because we're going to move in that direction so that we can talk about the potential forces behind this. But again, let's go back a little bit and talk about, you're talking about weaponry, special Russian space weaponry, actually. Is there any idea, if this is true, then is there any idea or theory about this at this point, why this were on its way from Estonia to Stockholm, Sweden?
Yes, because the Swedes had been a secret member of the NATO since 1948. They have always helped the Americans, and it was a very established smuggling route between the Baltic states and the former Soviet Union region and the Western world. And we know by a customer, a Swedish customer, who opened his mouth 10 years after the catastrophe, that there were weapons smuggled by the Swedish military secret service from Estonia. They never exactly described what kind of weapons, but he said there was military equipment.
Uh-huh.
And we know that it was at least one airplane ordered from the U.S. on Arlanda, the airport in Stockholm, and that the transport should have been made from the Stockholm harbor to the airport in Stockholm, Arlanda.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know exactly what it was, unfortunately. There are only rumors and hints, but nothing substantial.
Who do you think it were who was transporting this then? Was this Swedish Secret Service guys? Were these Estonians or Russians?
No, it was the Swedish military helped the American military to do it.
Yes.
There are hints that American soldiers were in the harbor of Tallinn helping to get those weapons on board. And then the Swedes took over, and so it was planned.
Yes.
But all this is very low evidence. We only have this customer who spoke out and who is trustworthy, and we have the information from the airport with the American airplane.
Yes.
Coming and leaving without anything, because the boat never made it through.
Yes, of course. And what about the potential involvement of KGB agents and things like this here, in this scenario?
Well, this is only hints and rumors, but no substantial evidence yet.
Okay. And there's numbers of elements within this, of course, that we can dive into. We can talk about, for instance, the possible disappearance, right, of Captain Avo Pitz. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Pitz.
Pitz, okay.
Pitz, Avo Pitz. Yes. The interesting situation that evening was that there were two captains on board, because every fortnight a relief crew took over, and the relief captain, Avo Pitz, who was not in charge, had to make an pilot's examine in the archipelago of Stockholm at 5 o'clock that morning, so it was planned. So he was on board, as well as the usual captain, Arvo Andersson, who did not survive. A lot of media and a lot of reliable resources broadcasted directly after the catastrophe in the morning and first half of the day of the 28th of September 94, that he was rescued. And
uh-huh.
Everybody, including his family, was very happy. And soon Interpol came out with an arrest order towards him, because they didn't get him, and they wanted to ask him several questions and so on.
Mm.
So there is very substantial and good proof that Pitz and at least 8 others survived and disappeared after. And one of them got murdered afterwards, Kalle Wachtras, and we suppose that they murdered him because he didn't want to play hide and seek and didn't want to take this role that he should get disappeared as the others.
Mm-hmm.
And there we got hints that some of them were transported to the United States and got a new identity under the Witness Protection Program and so on.
Okay. Very interesting. And I mean,
horrible, because their families still separated officially.
Yes, yes, of course. And you know, just let us go back once more and clarify this, because all these different elements are kind of it's a bit confusing for me. If they were transporting highly sensitive Russian weaponry from Estonia over to Sweden, and NATO were trying to get their hands on this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this then must have been someone who didn't want this material to end up in the hands of NATO, correct?
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
Correct.
So what we can probably assume at this point then is that it might be someone within, within either Estonia or the Russian state that were. I mean, do you have any theories on how they knew that this material were being transported, and they? I guess that they then got on board quickly and.
Yes, we have theories there, and we put it in our fiction film Baltic Storm, There was this Igor Kristapovich, a guy working for the customs in Tallinn, a former KGB officer, and he had a listening station, a listening post there. And he got in October 94, that means almost a month after the sinking of the vessel, murdered on open street in Tallinn, and the murder weapon was, as Jutta Rabe found out, from an army pistol of the Estonian army. So one could suppose that he, by his listening post, was informed about what was going on and tipped off the FSB or other Russian entities to stop that.
Okay, I see.
But this is not a proof.
No.
We only know the proof that he got murdered, but we don't know why.
And
we never came over the tapes, unfortunately.
Okay, but was he murdered on the boat?
No. 1 month later.
One month later. Okay. Yeah,
October 94, in the suburb of Tallinn, was an army pistol from the Estonian military.
Really. Okay. Huh. So this is, in a way, we could look at this whole thing as a kind of an extension, if you will, then on the Cold War, and in the eyes of NATO and the U.S. at least, this is a failure, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, one could do so.
Hmm. This is very interesting. And, you know, what about if we're going to talk a little bit about some of the consequent cover-up then? Because this might begin to make more sense then, because all this talk about, you know, the families want to have divers down there. They want to extract the evidence, so to speak. They want to take a look at the hull, what really happened. They want to examine the site, right? But this isn't allowed to take place through these different treaties that has been going on since between the Baltic states.
Yeah.
So what happened here? I mean, this was a big legal procedure, right? Were you involved in any way in the legal activities of this?
On the diving act that prohibits the diving, no. This I was not involved with, but I fought against that. It's very strange because the Estonia sank on open sea where no country has jurisdiction.
Yes.
And in spite of that, Sweden, Estonia, and Finland started to make a treaty between nations and said our citizens are not allowed to dive there and to be on the surface. I don't know how many square meters, but a big area on open sea, where they say they are not allowed to be. And a lot of experts from maritime law say this is not possible to make such a rule because it's an old tradition that everybody is free on open sea.
Yes.
And then the Swedes eagerly tried to get other countries to join this treaty. They even made efforts for Liechtenstein and Luxembourg to join the treaty, and they have no fleet or any maritime interest.
Sheesh, my God.
It's really ridiculous.
Yes.
And they succeeded time by time, even with Russia and Great Britain. And I intervened in Germany with the German government and others too. So the Germans did not sign, fortunately, that treaty. So Jutta Rabe had been always free from the German side to do that.
Yes. Have they in any way, because I haven't actually kept up with the story that much since then, but have they covered up in any way the wreck, or is it still open, so to speak?
No. There were plans to cover up the wreck with concrete in a way that the wreck is not smashed, but that the concrete is like a shell over it.
Yes.
And the Swedish state already paid for that. Huge amounts, I think about 300 million Swedish crowns. That is about 20 million euro.
Yes.
And 30 million euro, something about that.
Yes.
And then they made a attempts to start with that and to have a lot of stones to strengthen the seabed. And fortunately, the Estonia is lying on a slope and on a very weak seabed. So soon they had to realize nature did not allow a concrete shell. And then they lied and said, oh, we take care of the relatives and their protests, and therefore we don't realize our plans to cover it with concrete.
Yes.
But the real reason was that nature didn't allow it. It would have not worked out.
Huh. That's interesting. Do you know if there have been any subsequent, excursions, as it were, out there, and people who have, despite that there is a, you know, that you're not allowed to go down there, but they've done it anyway? You mentioned, of course, before that Utah Harbor had done an excursion and diving down there, but subsequently after that, do you know of anyone who's been down there?
No, not officially. There are a lot of rumors that there have been a lot of people. Once the leader of the relatives group I worked for told me that he got a phone call from a guy speaking Swedish with an American accent. It was in early 97, and he said, well, you should really do every effort to go down and save the corpses, because they are in a very good shape. I have just been down there. I had to take care of some papers from a lorry, and so in what a good shape the corpses are. There was a kind of testimony, and he said he made it for the United States.
Okay.
That they had been there. We see from different official diving pictures or ROV pictures in the period October to December 94 that the wreck changed position, that the ramp changed position, and other proofs that somebody had been there and worked heavily in the wreck and at the wreck. But we don't know who it exactly was.
So what we might be looking at this point is that all the potential sensitive, so to speak, material, the cargo or the potential weapons parts have actually been extracted and potentially are no longer in the hull.
Exactly.
Yes.
And Utah Harbor made this expedition with Greg Bremis from the United States. And he came up with a lot of money suddenly. And we got substantial hints later on that he was back up from the officials, from the military in the U.S., that he should control whether the Swedes made their task right in the cover-up, that nothing is left.
Really?
Compromising. Because Greg Bemis did not allow Jutta Rabe to take the metal pieces for the proof.
Mm-hmm.
There was almost a mutiny, she told me, and she got the crew on her side to overwhelm Greg Bemis to go down and take these metal pieces, which was a very substantial proof that the Weiser was blown off by bombs.
Yes.
Again, this is not declaring how it sank, because this is only declaring how the Weiser blew away.
Yes.
But anyhow, there is an act of terrorism.
Yes.
And Greg Bemis tried to interfere there.
Do you know who Greg, you know, potentially actually worked for then? I mean, you mentioned that he all of a sudden was handed a lot of money to continue or proceed with this.
No, we never found out exactly how he got it, and officially he's totally independent to the American establishment. But he earlier, they say, have worked for the military. But for me, it was quite clear that he was their pawn in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And that declares why he behaved in such a strange way.
Yes.
Not at all looking for truth, but helping with the cover-up.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was the courage from Jutta Rabe who saved this expedition.
Yes. Could there have been any kind of dangerous material there? They've been talked about potential, you know, radioactive material, something like that?
Could be, yeah, because Marek said that this German spy who was in Russian service, she said that there was an atomic battery, a cosmic battery on those satellite weapons where the Russians had been found a very good technology. And of course, this could give atomic leakage under the water and therefore concrete. But we don't know exactly. It is only speculation.
Yes. I want to do like this. I want to take a short break right here and then continue in our next segment and talk a little bit more about who actually potentially is behind the cover-up. And we definitely want to get into talking about the similarities between both this and 9/11 and also the 7/7 bombings in London. The procedure seems to be, you know, the same. And we'll get into and talk more about if the players are potentially the same as well. This is a fascinating story. Again, I want to mention just that film and tell us briefly about the film, The Baltic Storm, because you were part of the production in a way, isn't that right, Henning?
Yeah, that's right. When Jutta Rabe had made about 14 documentaries for Spiegel Television in Germany and they broadcasted it in other countries, the reaction was very flawed. The cover-up was so mighty in all the countries you came to, that I said, okay, let's make it like Molière and make a theater piece of it, and the modern theater is the cinema. Let's make a thriller of it, because we can't prove everything, but what we have a hint where everything is going. So Jutta and I started to write the treatment for Baltic Storm, the film was called, a fiction film, as close as possible to reality, telling the story of her, the journalist, and me, the lawyer.
Yes.
And therefore, this film got a little bit too much, perhaps, the character of a documentary, and got criticized for that. But anyhow, we made the film to start to stop the cover-up and to start a new discussion.
Yes.
But even this film fall victim to the cover-up, especially in the Scandinavian countries. No television station bought it. It was forbidden to be shown in official places in Sweden by authorities. And only two or three private cinemas in Sweden dared to show it.
Really?
It's really awful, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's as you mentioned before, Henning, I mean, it's a good movie in that sense. I mean, it does get the message out. It gives you a good overview of you know, what potentially might have happened. I mean, Donald Sutherland, I mean, is in there. I mean, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I recommend people to do take a look
Greta
at it.
Greta Skaki is not so bad either.
No, exactly.
Prochnow.
Exactly. No, very good actors in there. Again, the title is Baltic Storm, and this was released in 2003, and it should be available you know, either in a rental store or online or what have you.
Yeah, and Amazon, everywhere you can buy it, even in the States.
Yes. Okay, so let's take a short break here, Henning, then, and we'll continue to talk more here later on in our member section. So for this segment, thank you very much for coming on. Stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, welcome.